This podcast contains graphic descriptions that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Now, with that being said, welcome to the Mortal Musings podcast.
Right, let's do this. Lads, I really hope that someone out there is coming to see us at CrimeCon, because we had a little update from the organisers. There's 9 dogs going to be there. So I'm on my own. Megan's going to be just fucking off, going stroking dogs. That's me fucked. I've got to deal with public, other podcasters who've been going a lot longer than us. Like, can you imagine me holding down a conversation with Generation Y about true crime?
No. And then don't forget...
Laura Richards? You know, like, I'm going to get a detective come up to me and say, oh, so what cases have you covered? I can't remember. Hang on, let me ask Megan. Oh, I can't. She's over the other side of the room.
Screaming, can I pet that now? I'm going to be all about them dogs. I'm not even going to lie to you, Neil. Good luck if you see me over the weekend of CrimeCon. 9 dogs.
9. Are they sniffer dogs or what?
I'd say it's a mixture of maybe cadaver, drug.
Bomb. So yeah, that's...
Can I pet that now?
We have actually got a little shout out. We've never done a little shout out before. It's just a little tinsy-winsy shout out.
Tiny.
So we found out who our youngest fan... Well, not fan. Listener.
Listener.
Our youngest listener. She's only 10 years old. She's called Chewy. And one of the funniest messages we've ever received from a listener was from Chewy's mother, who said she listened to one of your episodes and asked me what bollock is. What a bollock is.
See, this is the thing, Neil. We're influencing the next generation.
Can you imagine being the parent and going, how do I go about this?
It's a weird one as well, because over here, I assume actually Americans are the same, but it's not like so much of a bad word over here. Like, it's still technically a curse, but it's so common.
But it's not just that.
Americans love it. They find it hilarious.
You've got multiple choices on answering it.
What do you mean?
Because bollocks is testicles.
Yeah.
But bollocks is also an idiot. It's also a fuck up.
You call someone who's a prick a bollocks. He's right, bollocks.
Yeah. Or if you drop something on the floor, bollocks.
Yeah. You got you dopey bollocks, you fucking bollocks, which is the more, you know, aggressive, you prick type of sound.
So I'd love to know what she told Chewy.
But she doesn't need to tell her anything. Just play this to her.
Yeah.
And she's going to know. Look, again, we're shaping the next generation.
Yeah. So Chewy, I'm pretty sure you're listening. So bollocks is...
Male genitalia.
If you drop something on the floor and you're annoyed about it, you might scream bollocks. If you're calling someone an idiot, there are bollocks. If you're at school...
It's a great all-rounder.
Yeah, if you're at school and you've got a class clown acting up, you can go, you're bollocks.
You're acting the bollocks. You can be acting the bollocks as well. Now, don't forget, that's an important one.
That is a very important one.
Hello, listeners. My name is Casey, host of the Cult Vault podcast, a long-format interview-based show that focuses on cults, high-demand groups, captive organizations, and more. Each week, I interview a different cult survivor who brings a story of coercion and exploitation along with their own fight for freedom. With nearly 200 survivor interviews from all over the world, you can also find deep dives into infamous cults, interviews with leading experts in the field, and understand more about how cults exist all around us, and none of us are safe. Each month, I feature a different author on the show who has penned a compelling memoir about their cult experiences, which we discuss at length on the show, with copies of their books available to listeners. You will never be short of insightful and moving content here at the Cult Vault podcast, available on all major platforms.
So, class adjourned, and we'll get on with the episode. What are we covering today?
Today, we are going to be covering the Torrey Pines beach murders.
That's a lot. Corey Pines? Who's
Torrey.
That? Torrey's?
Torrey Pines beach murders.
Where's that?
In California.
Okay.
I think this case is going to maybe piss you off a bit, intrigue you.
Intrigue me and piss me off?
Yeah, like, there's room for both.
Okay.
So, like I said, murders, there's multiple.
Okay.
So, the first person we're going to be talking about is Barbara Nantes. Barbara was described as someone who was outspoken, funny, but didn't take any shit. She was tough as nails and defiant. Her mother ever so delicately said that she was a beautiful pain in my ass, a wonderful daughter God gave to me to keep me humble. She was a middle child, one of four, two older sisters, Lorraine and Sue, and a younger brother, Tom. By the age of 15, Barbara was popular amongst other students and was part of her high school cheerleading squad.
Can you imagine a 15-year-old called Barbara?
Yeah, it doesn't quite sound right, does it?
No.
But I mean, I'm in that same boat. With the name Megan, I can't picture me being 65 years old. I don't know what I'm going to do when I get older.
Yeah, see, Neil? I don't know, actually.
You're good.
A toddler called Neil.
You can have a toddler called Neil. You can have a 35-year-old called Neil. You can have an 85-year-old called Neil. You're good. You're good to go.
Just imagine you're at school. Barbara. Deirdre.
But I actually love a lot of, you know, like older sounding names, like, you know, like Rita or Norma, any of them. Those type of ones.
Yeah.
Those type of ones, a name too. But you catch me drift.
Yeah.
Around this time in her life, Barbara was in a relationship with a 17-year-old, Jim Ault, who she'd been introduced to by her sister Sue.
Jim Ault.
Jim Ault.
Oh, that's two words.
Yeah, James Ault. That's his name. Jim Ault.
Yeah, Jim Ault.
Jim Ault.
I was like, what's that?
No, Jim Ault.
Okay.
Jim said about Barbara, she stole my heart the minute I saw her.
A 15-year-old?
He was 17. She was 15.
And she stole his heart?
She stole his heart, Neil.
At 17?
Why are you trying to bring Jim down? Jim was also said to have been popular, with friends describing him as being the life of the party and someone that others looked up to. Now, Jimbo was a surfer, even being featured in a magazine. And I tell you, Neil, Jim could not look more of a fucking Californian surfer in the 70s.
A douchebag.
I know, I need to show you a picture. You're like, he is the epitome of Californian surfer.
Has he got the like little patch of hair under his bottom lip?
No, but the hair is popping. Now, just look at this guy.
Okay, so, Hanson.
Hanson?
He looks like a member for fucking Hanson.
Yeah. Bob Hanson, yeah. He really does. His friend Rick said of Jim, he had a lot of girls that liked him, but he didn't see anybody else but her. So, as you can tell, Jim's smitten. He's like this fucking surfer lad. All the girls like the look of him. He's only got eyes for Barbara. She stole his heart, Neil, don't forget.
Yeah, 17.
Mm. I don't know why you're shitting on this so much. Like, when people are teenagers, it's always like hot and heavy, isn't it? It's always like really fucking intense.
Yeah, but you're always, right. I don't know what it's like for teenage girls. I'm pretty sure it's the same. But like, anyone I was with as a teenager, yeah, I was smitten. It's like, they're the one. It took me until I was 26? Took me until I was 26 to actually know what love is.
That's fast maths.
Wow. it took me until I was 26 to actually know what love is.
Meet someone you didn't despise.
Yes.
On the 12th of August, 1978, Barbara's parents, Ralph and Judy, were going out of town to visit some friends. Now, the kids were pretty much able to take care of themselves at this stage, but a family friend would be stopping by to check in on Barbara and her siblings. Before her parents left for the trip, her father Ralph pulls Jim to the side to have a word in private. He asked Jim to look after his daughter. He told him, take care of my girl, make sure she's safe. And to that, Jim reassured her parents that he would and that they'd stay put.
Mm.
But after her parents left, Jim and Barbara hopped in the car with Jim's friend Rick, along with his girlfriend, and headed to the beach. He would later say it was the biggest lie and biggest mistake he's ever made. But I mean...
The biggest lie?
Teenagers. They're going to act the bollocks. They're going to lie. That's what they do. They're teenagers.
But that's the biggest lie.
Well, you're going to find out why. Now, when they arrive, there's loads of people on the beach. The car park was rammed. But as the day went on and people started to filter out, they decided to settle down for the evening. At about 9 p.m, Barbara and Jim went down to the beach to set up camp, while Rick and his girlfriend decided to stay in the station wagon.
Station wagon. Of course he has.
I know. Don't you love it? You really, do you know, I mean, like California beach, you've seen a picture of Jim, station wagon, you really, it's really setting the scene, yeah. Isn't it? Jim said that the last thing he remembers that night was falling asleep with Barbara in his arms. Oh, fuck, I'm loving Jim. He seems so sweet.
Until he isn't. It's like a true crime documentary, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was the loveliest man ever. Until he wasn't.
And that's when you cut in the dun-dun.
Yeah, and it goes like negative.
Yeah.
And then he wasn't.
The next morning, Jim wakes up. He's freezing cold, he's on his own, and he's covered in blood. Disoriented, he reaches out for Barbara, but he can't find her. Now, he can hardly see anything at this stage, and he actually had to feel his way up a fence to get to the parking lot to reach his friends.
Wait, so he's woke up on his own?
Yeah.
Covered in blood?
He's in a different location to where he remembers falling asleep. He's clearly been attacked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just about to say, there's not a chance whatever has happened to Barbara, to the fact that her blood is all over him, but he didn't wake up.
No,
in the
no.
Attack.
He's been through some shit himself.
Okay.
So like I said, he wakes up, he feels his way up the fence to get to the car park. He gets to Rick's station wagon. I don't know why station wagon's funny to him, sorry.
Where's Rick?
Rick's in the station wagon.
Okay.
Don't worry, we can rule out Rick, don't worry.
What about his mom?
She's with him.
Okay.
So he gets to the station wagon.
Yeah.
He bangs on the window, Rick looks up. And Rick says that he was only able to recognise Jim by his hair because his face was just covered in blood.
Hmm.
He tells Rick that he doesn't know where Barbara is and he asks Rick to go down to the beach and find her. Rick makes his way down to the beach where he finds Barbara laid in the sand, nude. She had been sexually assaulted, beaten and strangled. Her breasts had also been mutilated. Sand was also found in her mouth.
I wonder if that means from a struggle, or if they, while she's laid on her back, yeah. They've put loads of sand in her mouth.
From how they were talking about it, it sounded as if it had been placed there.
Okay.
Now, at this point in time, Jim isn't in good shape. He desperately needs help. So Jim is rushed to the hospital, where he's put into a coma.
That bad?
Yes. His injuries were the result of having been beaten with a rock and also a log from a nearby fire pit. A titanium plate. Now, that sounded really unnatural.
Titanium plate?
Yeah, I didn't think I'd have an issue with this either, Neil, but apparently I'm fucking wrong. A titanium plate was fitted to replace where his skull had been crushed.
Well, that's him fucked at airports.
Well, Jim's been through the fucking wars as well with this, you know?
And then after all that, every time he wants to go on holiday, he's going to be fucking mauled by security. Can you imagine how much of a ball like that it'll be?
Yeah.
Like, even if you go into a football game, it's got to go through a fucking scanner. Empty your pockets. They are empty.
So who committed this brutal attack? Well, Jim was investigated, but he was ruled out.
How the fuck was he investigated?
Just, you know, he was the boyfriend and he was there, but like you're saying, how the fuck?
He was fucked!
Yeah, his injuries were just too severe for this to have been, you know, some kind of setup that he, like, made it look that way. He was fucked. He'd been through the wars.
Yeah.
Now, when Jim woke up, he had no memory of the attack. So, I mean...
So he concussed then?
Yeah. Like, I suppose it was a good thing that he doesn't have to deal with the memory of that, but obviously it's harder then to identify who did this. And also, could you imagine how frustrating that is for Jim to be trying to get justice and for himself as well as Barbara, obviously. And unfortunately, as time went on, there was no leads and the case went cold. With no one to lay blame on, Barbara's parents turned their frustrations towards Jim. They were upset with Barbara for going out that night, but they were furious with Jim for going against his words.
Oh yeah, that's heavy guilt, that.
Yeah. Her father said that he didn't want to see him, didn't want to talk to him. In his eyes, Jim didn't keep his daughter safe like he had promised he would. Now, 6 years later, in 1984, a 14-year-old girl named Claire Huff was staying with her grandparents for the summer, just a few blocks away from the Torrey Pines beach. Claire was described as smart, gentle, funny, and kind. She was also said to have been very spirited. And Claire used that energy to always stand up for what was right and would often find herself in the position of mediator amongst her peers. Now, Claire loved the beach, and she spent a lot of time there with her best friend Kim, who had come along for the summer with her and her siblings. And actually, one of the first pictures of Claire when she was a little kid was taken at this beach.
Just want to quickly say, I don't know what everyone's obsession is with beaches. They are fucking horrible.
What do you mean?
Like, if it's really hot weather, like, I remember when I went to Greece, and I walked across the beach to the sea. And I don't know if a cloud had moved or what. And I must have been in the sea for 10, 15 minutes. I couldn't walk back to my shoes and everything because the sand was that hot. It was scalding my feet. So I was stuck. And I was just like, I hate beaches. This is...
Okay, but you grew up inland. I grew up on the coast. It was part of my childhood going down to the beach. It was something you did.
Right, what she's calling a beach... There is not one speck of sand.
It is a beautiful beach.
It's rocks. You're walking on little rocks. And then told you can't take any rocks because it's illegal.
No, you can't take rocks. You can't rob rocks off the beach.
No, I've never seen the fascination with beaches. If you like swimming, go to a swimming pool.
See, you say that, but when we first met, and you're like, oh my God, you live by the beach? Oh, it's amazing. You don't know how lucky you are. Do you remember that?
I did.
Just because you don't live near one?
No, I like the noise of the ocean.
So you do like beaches?
No, I like the noise of the ocean. I like water. It's that bit in between.
On the 24th of August, Claire...
Has anyone else noticed she just cuts me off and fucks off with the story?
On the 24th of August, Claire's body was found laid in the sand. The previous evening, she had gone out for a walk along the beach with a portable radio and a pack of cigarettes.
14?
Yeah. What were you doing at 14, Neil?
Never you mind.
Her body was found just a few hundred yards from where Barbara's body had been found. Claire had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled. Her breast had been mutilated, and sand was found in her mouth.
Is there any arses around here?
Houses?
Yeah.
You literally just said arses.
Arses?
I don't actually know the beach very well, but like I said, her grandparents live a few blocks, so...
No, just... Because someone's got to get away from this quick.
I seen a picture of where the body had been found, and it looked like it was by a road. It sounds familiar, though, this attack, doesn't it?
It's exactly the same.
Exactly. It's a carbon fucking copy of what had happened to Barbara.
And they're both underage as well.
Yeah, they're both young girls, 14 and 15.
Did they look similar?
Similar enough, yeah. Her friend Kim, who had come with her and her siblings for the summer, she had actually headed back home to Rhode Island before the murder had happened. But on one of the evenings, while Claire and Kim sat on the beach, Kim said that she had become overwhelmed with a feeling of dread, so much so that she said she didn't think that they should be going back there at night.
Who had the feeling, Kim or the victim?
Kim. You kind of wonder, was there someone hanging around? You just get that feeling you're getting watched, or, you know what I mean? So something that got me about Claire was that at just 14 years old, she had already written a will. In this will, she says, "You made me realise how precious and beautiful life is. Thank you. I wish I could list all the wonderful things you've done, but everyone would fall asleep. I love you both." Right in the fucking heart, huh? 14 years old. Now, again, same as with Barbara's murder, there was no immediate suspect.
Where was Jim?
Imagine they came after Jim.
Thing is, you said they were, like, honing in on Jim. But why weren't anyone honing in on Rick?
Well, they sussed him out. Well, they might have questioned Rick, for all I know.
Oh.
I just didn't say anything about it. But they weren't honing in.
You said that.
They did question him. But they kind of, like, it was kind of like, I'm guessing it was more of the formality of, like, he's the boyfriend, he was there, we have to.
Not really, when he's half-dead himself.
The chap's head was caved in, yeah. Like, come on, lads. So, no immediate suspect.
Yeah.
But an interesting character did emerge. someone who would raise a few eyebrows and would actually go on to become a person of interest. And that was Wallace Wheeler. And he was the man who had found Claire's body.
We've had this discussion before.
Oh, about being the one to find the body?
Yes.
Mm. Well, let me tell you about Wallace.
Oh, okay. I've got a feeling I'm not going to like Wally.
Well, Claire's parents, Sam and Penny Huff, were in contact with old Wally. I think he reached out to them. And they described him as a strange guy. And being a little bit uneasy around him, they went to the police.
Thing is, saying he's a strange guy, he could be a bit mentally unstable because he's just found a dead body.
Could be. But let me get into it. I'm a bit sus of him. So, yeah, they went to police, and the police encouraged Sam and Penny to stay in communication with Wallace, in hopes that he might confess to the murder or possibly give some sort of information that could, you know, help the case along.
Yeah.
But the only thing that Wallace confesses to is that he's a psychic.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Right, that's it. Throw him under the bus.
He goes on to write these long, rambling, and quite honestly creepy letters to Claire's parents. One of them saying that Claire was coming to him in visions. And understandably, this disturbed her parents. I think her father says it best when he says, "This is a guy who found a bloodied, mutilated body, and he's talking about a smiling face and radiant eyes." That's what he said about Claire in his visions. Like, okay. Come on. Wallace was questioned by police, but he never confessed to anything. And the letters would eventually stop. The last thing that Claire's parents heard about Wallace was that he had ended his life. He had jumped from a 13-story building. But by this stage, investigators had already ruled him out and the case was cold. But for years, Claire's parents were convinced that he was the one who had killed their daughter.
Second, there's no DNA evidence on either of these bodies.
We'll get to it. So these murders are very similar in terms of the type of the attack, the location, and also the victims are fairly similar in looks and age.
Yeah.
You think they will be linked?
Yeah.
Barbara and Claire's parents didn't even know of each other's daughter's murders until years later.
Well, so the police didn't even link it?
No.
Two teenage girls on the same beach, sand didn't gob, breast cut off.
Yeah.
Within a year.
Yeah. Six years apart.
6 years apart.
But yeah, and bear in mind, where Claire's body was found was only a few hundred yards from where Barb was found.
It's a cop.
So Barbara's murder happened in 1978. Claire's in 1984.
Yeah.
In 2008, police announced that they believe these murders were connected and that these girls had been murdered by the same man.
Wait, how? So hang on. So it took these fucking Einsteins 24 years to link the two cases?
Mm-hmm.
So you'd expect this out in like a hillbilly fucking, you know, banjo music sort of fucking area. You know, they're not good with numbers and such, but this is LA, isn't it?
California, yeah. Now, they didn't even have a suspect at this point. It was based off the similarities in the two murders, which...
No shit.
Yeah, you fucking think. It wasn't until 2012 that the cases were reopened. With the advancements that had been made in forensic technology, they were hoping they could get a DNA match. Barbara's mother described how she felt at this time as cautiously optimistic. And they did manage to get a match. Two suspects emerged through DNA testing.
Two on both or one on each?
This is from testing from Claire's murder.
Okay.
Blood on Claire's jeans was linked to a man named Ronald Clyde Tatrow. Let me tell you about Ronald.
Okay.
Ronald was a convicted rapist with a history of sexual assaults.
In the area?
I assume so.
And they didn't hone in on him?
Well...
Because that's what they do, don't they?
Yeah.
Like, say if you could have someone who's got some sort of child assault charge on them, but they haven't done anything for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
But then if a kid in that area, if something happens to them, If they ain't got a suspect, that's what they'll do. They'll start going round to the houses of people who are on the
register.
And this guy was a convicted rapist.
Yes. In fact, in 1995, a year after Claire's murder, he was sentenced to 3 years after he had kidnapped a 16-year-old girl. He had lured her into his van, where he would attempt to use a stun gun to subdue her before sexually assaulting her. Now, luckily, the girl managed to escape and was able to get his license plate and give it to the police, and he was arrested.
Fair fucks to her.
I know. So, he's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And police are like, I think we should talk to Ronald.
Like, really, fair fucks to her.
Yeah.
Because...
to have the cop on to get the plate after that.
I shouldn't be saying this publicly, but if you wanted to kidnap me and I saw your number plate, don't be scared. I'm not memorising that.
No, I'd be weeping and soiling myself. Honestly.
I wouldn't be weeping and soiling myself, but if police came up to me after and went, did you look at his number plate? I did, yeah. What was it?
It was definitely a Dublin reg, or yeah. It might have been a Leash reg. I'm not quite sure about that. Look, keep an eye out for both.
Could have been a British reg.
Yeah. Was it yellow? But yeah, no, he's a piece of shit, and obviously police want to talk to him. So they go to find Ronald. Instead of finding Ronald, what they find out is that Ronald had died the previous year at the age of 67. Ronald had drowned in the Holston River in Tennessee in what was ruled as a boating accident. The thing about this is, his wallet and glasses were placed neatly on the seat of the boat, which would indicate that his death was intentional.
Suicide.
Yeah. His death was also on the anniversary of Claire's murder.
Oh.
Yeah. So like I said, there's two suspects through the DNA. So they go to talk to their only living suspect, Kevin Brown. Now, Kevin's DNA, a microscopic amount, was found on a vaginal swab taken from Claire's body.
He's got no hope of getting out of that then.
Kevin Brown was a former criminologist in the San Diego Police Department Crime Lab who had retired in 2002.
I told you! What did I say earlier? It's a cop!
And with that, I think we're going to leave it here for part one.
Fuck off.
Of the Torrey Pines Beach murders.
No.
Oh, yeah. You okay, Neil?
No, I'm livid because I was onto this at the start.
Yeah, you were, weren't you?
You fucking poker face prick, you. I said it was someone in law enforcement.
Right, you know, I'm going to take that as a fucking compliment because I can't lie for jack shit. So thank you.
You didn't bat an eyelid when I said someone in law enforcement. I knew it was some shady shit.
I am so proud of myself.
I can sniff it. I'm leaving that in. That's staying in. Right, fuck you. We'll quickly do an audit and then we can do part two. So
here's the thing, lads. Because we're recording this, we're going to record part one and part two in the same day. So Neil's devastated, but he's going to actually get it pretty quick. He's going to get to find the conclusion to this.
Yeah, and I can wind up. Yeah. Our regular listeners be like, I know what happens in part two. Well, just give me a fucking audit.
The deaths of Layla and Raymond Howard.
I know this one.
Do you?
No.
On the 29th of June, 1997, 83-year-old Layla and 88-year-old Raymond Howard set off in their Oldsmobile from their home in Salado, Texas, to make the 15-mile trip to their favourite fiddle festival in Temple, Texas.
Fiddle festival?
Yeah, no, I know what you're thinking. How could you possibly choose between fiddle festivals? How can you have a favourite fiddle festival? I didn't even know they were a fucking thing until I did this. Had you ever heard of a fiddle festival?
There's a festival for everything, isn't there?
Fiddle festival.
Think of something. There's a festival for it.
But it's not just...
Nothing surprises me anymore. People are out there now collecting rocks and calling them healing crystals and shit.
No, but it's not just that they were going to their favourite fiddle festival. That is fucking hard to say. It's the fact that there is enough fiddle festivals for them to have a favourite.
Did it sound horrible, that?
Yeah.
Mm.
But sure, look, anyway, they head out like they do every year to have a grand old time at the fiddle festival. This is where things go awry. Layla and Raymond didn't return home from the Fiddle Festival.
Just say the festival.
I like saying Fiddle Festival. I think it adds to it. And obviously, they're older. Their family are extremely concerned as to their whereabouts. So they contact the police, and after searching for 13 days, Layla and Raymond's car was found more than 350 miles away in Arkansas.
Fucking hell.
At the bottom of a 25-foot ravine.
Jesus.
Raymond's body was found in the passenger seat, and Layla was found about 20 foot from the car with her purse and car keys in her hand. We still don't know for sure why they ended up so far from home, but we do know that Layla was starting to show signs of dementia while Raymond had recently suffered a stroke and had undergone brain surgery.
So family members were okay with them driving 15 miles?
No, Layla's son had actually wanted to drive them. But I think they were kind of like, no, we do this every year. We can do, you know what I mean?
Hmm.
Like one of our previous oddities, this story would actually go on to inspire a song, The Way by Fastball.
But where were they going without ever knowing the way?
It's a fucking mental story, this, because it's so fucking sad. It's two older people who are just trying to do what they normally do. They go to their favourite fiddle festival.
Yeah. What year was this?
97. It's a really shocking thing to have happened. Like, obviously it's devastating, you know, that whatever had happened, you know, with her dementia or, you know, him having gone through a stroke.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. Over 350 miles away.
Yeah.
In a different fucking state. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, because they'd have had to keep stopping for gas.
They did actually get pulled over twice.
By cops?
On their trip. Once was for not having the lights on, but they just got a warning and let them go. And the next time was for having their main beam on.
So one was for not having the lights on and one was for having too much.
Yeah, so Layla, who was driving, was obviously like, oh yeah, no bother, switch that light on. Fucking blind every other fucker on the road. But it is crazy. Like, it's 13 days they were looking for them, over 350 miles away. Police had stopped them on the way, you know?
Fuck.
And also the whole thing of her getting out of the car, making it 20 feet and like the purse and the keys in her hand still.
Yeah.
Mm.
So she basically wrote the car off.
Yeah.
And just got out and just started walking.
Yeah.
And she was how far away from the car?
Only about 20 feet.
Oh.
Hmm.
I suppose it's impressive, but they got that far. Didn't end well, but they got that far.
Like a Bonnie and Clyde type of situation. What if it was?
What? And the crime's putting the main
beam
on.
They stole all the fiddles out the festival.
The crime's putting main beam on.
Well, they only got a warning for that, Neil.
No, that is a sad, sad story, that.
It is. It's very sad.
Yeah, like, the only thing what's bothering me about this is you've ended the episode on a cliffhanger. Not only that, it's something I was saying from the fucking start, which I'm really impressed with. And then you depressed the shite out of me with that, oddity.
I did, yeah.
So, thanks for that.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for listening. Find us on Patreon, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. If you have a case suggestion, or maybe even your own story, email us at mortalmusingspodcast@gmail.com.